堂听 class.com。
Whose self is it anyway? By Philip Kitcher. Lamb number 6LL3, better known as Dolly, took the world by surprise in February 1997 when she was introduced as the first creature ever cloned from an adult mammal. Recognizing that what is possible with sheep today will probably be feasible with human beings tomorrow,commentators speculated about the legitimacy of cloning a Pavarotti or an Einstein, about the chances that a demented dictator might produce an army of super soldiers, about the future of basketball in a world where a team of Larry Birds could play against a team of Michael Jordans. Dolly's debut introduces real and pressing moral issues.Cloning will not enable anyone to duplicate people like so many cookie-cutter gingerbread men, but it will pave the way for creating children who can fulfill their parents' preordained intentions. As most people know by now, the recent breakthroughs in cloning came from the far less glamorous world of animal husbandry and agriculture.A team of investigators at the Roslin Institute near Edinburgh, Scotland, led by Ian Wilmot, conjectured that past efforts to clone mammals had failed because the cell that supplies the nucleus and the egg that received it were at different stages of the cell cycle. Applying well-known techniques from cell biology, Wilmot starved the cells so that both were in an inactive phase at the time of transfer. Inserting nuclei from adult sheep cells in that quiescent phase gave rise to a number of embryos, which were then implanted into ewes. In spite of a high rate of miscarriage, one of the pregnancies continued to term. After beginning with 277 transferred adult nuclei,Wilmot and his co-workers obtained one healthy lamb, the celebrated Dolly. Wilmot's achievement raised three important questions about the prospect of human cloning. Will it be possible to undertake the same operations on human cells? Will cloners be able to reduce the high rate of failure?And just what is the relation between a clone obtained through nuclear transplantation and the animals born in the usual way from which the clone is derived? Answers to the first two questions are necessarily tentative. Predicting even the immediate trajectory of biological research is always vulnerable to contingencies.In the late 1960s, for example, after the developmental biologist J.B. Gurdon, now of the University of Cambridge, produced an adult frog through cloning, it seemed that cloning all kinds of animals was just around the corner. A few years later, the idea of cloning adult mammals had returned to the realm of science fiction. But leaving aside any definite time frame,one can reasonably expect that Wilmot's technique will eventually work on human cells and that failure rates will be reduced. What about the third question, however, the relation between parent animal and clone? There, one can be more confident. Dolly clearly has the same nuclear genetic material as the ewe that supplied the inserted nucleus.A second ewe supplied the egg into which that nucleus was inserted. Hence, Dolly's mitochondrial DNA came from another source. Indeed, though the exact roles played by mitochondrial DNA and other contents of the cytoplasm in vertebrate development are still unclear, one can say this much. Dolly's early development was shaped by the interaction between the DNA in the nucleus and the contents of the egg cytoplasm, the contributions of two adult females. A third sheep, the ewe into which the embryonic Dolly was implanted, provided Dolly with a uterine environment. Dolly thus has three mothers, nuclear mother, egg mother, and womb mother, and no father, unless, of course, one accords that honour to Wilmot for his guiding role. Now, imagine Holly, a human counterpart of Dolly. You might think Holly would be similar to her nuclear mother, perhaps nearly identical, particularly if the mother of the nuclear mother were also the womb mother, and if either that woman or the nuclear mother were the egg mother. Such a hypothetical circumstance would ensure that Holly and her donor shared a similar gestation experience, as well as both nuclear and mitochondrial DNA. Whether they would share other cytoplasmic constituents is anyone's guess, because the extent of the differences among eggs from a single donor is still unknown. But even if all Holly's genetic material and her intrauterine experience matched those of a single donor, Holly would not be an exact replica of that human being. Personal identity, as philosophers since John Locke have recognized, depends as much on life experiences as on genetics. Memories, attitudes, prejudices, and emotional attachments all contribute to the making of a person. Cloning creates babies, not fully formed adults, and babies mature through a series of unique events. You could not hope to ensure the survival of your individual consciousness by arranging for one of your cells to be cloned. Megalomaniacs with intimations of immortality need not apply. Other environmental factors would also lead to differences between Holly and her donor. For one thing, the two would likely belong to different generations, and the gap in their ages would correspond to changes in educational trends, the adolescent subculture, and other aspects of society that affect children's development. Perhaps even more important, Holly and her donor would be raised in different families, with different friends, close relatives, teachers, neighbors, and mentors. Even if the same couple acted as parents to both, the time gap would change the familial circumstances. If the cloning of human beings is undertaken in the hope of generating a particular kind of person, then cloning is morally repugnant. The repugnance arises not because cloning involves biological tinkering, but because it interferes with human autonomy. To discover whether circumstances might exist in which cloning would be morally acceptable, one must ask whether the objectionable motive can be removed. Imagine a couple's only son is dying and needs a kidney transplant within 10 years. Unfortunately, neither parent can denote a compatible organ, and it may not be possible to procure an appropriate one from the existing donor pool. If a brother were produced by cloning, one of his kidneys could be transplanted to save the life of the elder son. Imagine a woman's beloved husband has been killed in an automobile accident. As a result of the same crash, the couple's only daughter lies in a coma with irreversible brain damage. The widow, who can no longer bear children, wants to have the nuclear DNA from one of her daughter's cells inserted into an egg supplied by another woman, so that a clone of her child can be produced through surrogate motherhood. In some cases, like these, cloning may turn out to be morally justified, yet lingering concerns remain. In the first scenario, and to a lesser extent in the second, the disinterested bystander suspects that children are being subordinated to the special purposes or projects of adults. Perhaps the parents, in the case of the dying child, have no desire to expand their family. For them, the younger brother would simply be a means of saving the really important life. Similarly, the grieving widow might be motivated solely by nostalgia for the happy past, so that the child produced by cloning could be valuable only because she was genetically close to the dead. Should human cloning be banned? For the moment, while biology and medicine remain ignorant of the potential risks, the miscarriages and malformed embryos that could result, a moratorium is surely justified. But what if future research on non-human mammals proves reassuring? Then, cloning would be permissible in a small range of cases. Those cases must satisfy two conditions. First, there must be no effort to create a child with specific attributes. Second, there must be no other way to provide an appropriate biological connection between parent and child. Although infertile couples sometimes suffer great distress, further investment in technologies such as cloning may not be the best way to bring them relief.